The evidence is overwhelming.
Billions of years.
The science has settled this.
But has it really?
He's a double major, physics and astronomy, holding a PhD in astrophysics from the same universities that teach what he now dismantles. He's also a published author, a Fortis Fellow, and a Christian who believes the Bible means exactly what it says. This is In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
What is the age of the universe? Does science confirm what the Bible teaches? Hi, folks. I'm Jason Lyle, president and founder of the Biblical Science Institute and fellow at Fortis Institute. You know, the Bible teaches that God created the entire universe in 6 days a few thousand years ago. However, most secular scientists today believe that the universe popped into existence in a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, and that it took billions of years for the cosmos to evolve to its current state. Have the secularists finally shown that God's word is wrong? Of course, 1,000 years from now, today's science will be ancient history. Our present understanding of science will seem as antiquated 1,000 years from now as we feel about the science from 1,000 years ago. But God's word will still be true. Even more indicting is the abundance of evidence from the field of astronomy available today that confirms the biblical timescale and which is inconsistent with secular timescales. But how are we to evaluate scientific evidence with regard to age? Age indicates how far into the past something began, but science is predicated upon observation and experimentation in the present. We can neither observe the past nor experiment on the past because it is gone. About the best we can do scientifically is make some assumptions about the initial state of the system, whose age we want to know, and some assumptions about the rate of change of that system, and make an estimate based on our observations of the current state. Of course, creationists and secularists have the same evidence available to them in the present, but they make different assumptions about the initial state and rates of change, and this causes them to draw radically different conclusions about age. For example, the secularist typically embraces naturalism, the assumption that there is no supernatural action from God, and uniformitarianism, the assumption that present rates and conditions are indicative of past rates and conditions. Conversely, the creationist accepts that the origin of the universe was a supernatural event, and that there have been one or more catastrophes, unlike anything happening today, such as the global flood, that have shaped Earth's features. Since the different assumptions involve past events, supernatural creation versus natural, uniformitarianism versus catastrophism, they cannot be directly tested by scientific means, since the past cannot be experimented upon or observed. Now, does that mean that the creationist interpretation of the evidence and the secular interpretation are equally rational? Well, no. We can see that the secular interpretation is irrational by performing an internal critique. This is where we assume, for the sake of hypothesis, the secular assumptions, naturalism and uniformitarianism, and show that they lead to a conclusion that is inconsistent with the secular timescale. In most cases, the estimates are an upper limit on the age of a system that is far less than the age required in the secular model. The only rational conclusion we can draw is that either the secular timescale is wrong, the assumptions it is based on are wrong, or both. So let's look at some specific lines of evidence from the field of astronomy. Did you know the moon is actually receding from the Earth due to tidal forces? The gravity of the moon pulls on Earth's oceans, inducing two tidal bulges, one on the moon-facing side and one on the opposite side as the Earth is pulled away from that ocean. Now, the Earth rotates faster than the moon revolves around it, so the tidal bulges are always a bit ahead of the moon and therefore pull forward on it. A forward force applied on an orbiting object increases the object's energy, causing it to move outward in its orbit. So the moon's orbit gradually enlarges. We can measure the distance to the moon very precisely by bouncing laser beams off reflectors left on its surface during the Apollo missions. Science confirms that the moon moves about 1.5 inches farther away from the Earth every year. Now, in the past, the moon would have been closer to the Earth, which means the tidal bulges would have been much larger, producing a much greater forward thrust on the moon, and the rate of recession would be faster. From first principles of physics, the rate of recession is inversely proportional to the 6th power of distance. The uniformitarian assumption here is that this would always have been the case. Using calculus, we can compute the maximum possible age of the Earth-Moon system by integrating lunar recession back to a time when the Earth and Moon would have been in the same place at the same time. Now, obviously this is an upper limit because they cannot be closer than that, but they could have started further away. We find that the answer is 1.45 billion years. Now, that may sound like a long time, but remember that, first of all, it is based on the secular assumptions. Second, the 1.45 billion years is an upper limit. It represents a maximum possible age because the Earth and Moon cannot be closer than a distance of zero. But the secular age is supposedly 4.5 billion years, which is much greater than the maximum possible age. Now, the secularists can avoid this devastating conclusion only by relinquishing their assumptions of uniformitarian and naturalism. But apart from those assumptions, there would be no reason to believe in billions of years in the first place. Earth's magnetic field is another indicator. For nearly two centuries, scientists have been able to measure the strength of Earth's magnetic field and have kept records of their measurements. These records show that the Earth's magnetic field has been gradually dropping over time. Actually, this isn't surprising. We would expect it on the basis of physics principles. Magnetic fields are caused by electrical current in the Earth's interior. But electrical current encounters resistance and decays over time, just as a battery gradually runs down. We would expect from first principles that this would be an exponential decay. The decrease was faster in the past and slows at a rate proportional to the current's strength. Records of the magnetic field strength are consistent with this. The half-life appears to be approximately 1,400 years, though some estimates are even less. This means that every 1,400 years into the past, the Earth's magnetic field strength doubles. It would have been 20 times greater at creation, about 6,000 years ago, assuming the half-life has always been 1,400 years, which is the uniformitarian assumption. But when we run the exponential decay back in time to a hypothetical 60,000 years ago, Earth's magnetic field would have been greater than that of a neutron star, and life would be impossible. Again, this is not an indicator of the true age of the Earth, that it's supposedly 60,000 years. Rather, it is an estimate of the maximum possible age, one that is wildly inconsistent with the standard secular beliefs. Now, secular scientists have attempted to alleviate this problem by claiming that the Earth somehow recharges its magnetic field over time. They have claimed that a dynamo exists in Earth's interior, which causes the magnetic field to regularly reverse and recharge before again decaying and flipping back. They suppose it is similar to the process on the Sun, which causes the Sun's dipole magnetic field to reverse polarity every 11 years. But there are two problems with this dynamo hypothesis. First, a dynamo requires differential rotation, where the equator rotates faster than the poles, and a toroidal magnetic field, in other words, an east-west looping field, in addition to its dipole field, the north-south field. Now, the Sun has both of these things. It is a ball of plasma and rotates differentially. The equator rotates significantly faster than the poles, and the Sun has a toroidal field, an east-west oriented field that wraps around the Sun like a belt. There is at least one toroidal field in each hemisphere of the Sun, but the Earth has neither of these things. The Earth rotates as a solid body, meaning the angular velocity is the same everywhere, and there is no evidence that the Earth has a toroidal magnetic field, only a dipole north-south field. Now, during the flood year, we do believe that the poles flipped multiple times due to the rapid motion of the continents that was taking place at that time. That could cause enough disturbances in the current to temporarily reverse the fields. But of course, that's not happening today, at least not at an appreciable rate. And furthermore, secular scientists reject the global flood because it is incompatible with their assumption of uniformitarianism. Second, no one has really demonstrated that a dynamo like the solar one can actually recharge a magnetic field or allow it to persist over time. In fact, a dynamo might actually drain the magnetic energy even faster than a free decay. So a dynamo is unlikely to rescue deep time from evidence to the contrary. And frankly, it's not just the Earth. Many of the planets have magnetic fields consistent with the biblical age of about 6,000 years. Magnetic fields just don't last very long. Therefore, the abundance of strong magnetic fields in the solar system is very strong support for recent creation. Basically, there are two factors that determine how long a planet can maintain a magnetic field: size and composition. Larger planets are like larger batteries. They take longer to run down. Unsurprisingly, Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system, has the strongest magnetic field. Furthermore, conductive materials will maintain electrical current and the resulting magnetic field better than insulating materials. Hence, the tiny planet Mercury still has a weak magnetic field due to its iron core, but the slightly larger Mars does not. Mars does have remnant magnetism. The rocks have traces of magnetism, although the dipole field of the planet is long gone. Remnant magnetism indicates that the planet once had a global magnetic field, like Earth, but in 6,000 years it has decayed away. The Moon also has remnant magnetism. The evidence is very consistent with the biblical timescale of about 6,000 years. In fact, creationists successfully predicted the magnetic fields of the planets Uranus and Neptune before these fields were measured by the Voyager 2 spacecraft. Dr. Russ Humphreys predicted the amount of decay based on a biblical age of 6,000 years. His predictions were consistent with the measurements. The secular predictions were wrong. Technology has now advanced to the point where we can detect some planets orbiting other stars. My prediction is that some of these planets will show evidence of strong magnetic activity. This would further confirm their biblical age of a few thousand years. Now, when we come back from a short break, we'll continue to discuss evidence that confirms the biblical timescale of about 6,000 years.
And we'll be back with more from Dr. Jason Lyle in just a moment. And I want you to think about just a moment how unusual it is that you're even hearing this at all. We're listening to a man with a doctorate in astrophysics. He's been trained at the same universities that teach the opposite of the things that he's saying here today. And he's working through lunar recession and magnetic decay, things I don't understand, but he's working through these things using language you can actually follow. Tell you what, that's a combination that barely exists anywhere else. And you know, it takes real money to produce this type of content, to record it, to produce it, and to get it in front of people just like you. And that's where Fortis Plus shines. Not just Fortis Plus, but our gospel partners, because no one is paying for this with advertising. There's no sponsor behind any of this. What funds this is a group of believers, we call them gospel partners. They're committed and believe in the mission of Fortis Institute so much that they wanted to join us as ongoing monthly gospel partners so that more people in more places all over the world would have access to this type of content. And consider just a moment what their money actually accomplishes. Because there's a high school student out there right now sitting in a science class that treats billions of years as something that's beyond being questioned, but he hears a real scientist like Dr. Lyle tell him the exact opposite that his secular school is telling him. Think about the father who's never had answers for his kids and he's finally getting some because he's listening to this podcast. Or the skeptic who runs across this podcast and he's listening because, well, he thinks he's going to be amused and he thinks he's going to hear Christians who don't think for themselves. But when he listens, he finds out otherwise. None of those people pay a dime for this content. And that's the heartbeat of this ministry. We want people all over the world to have access to all of the content that we're creating, but it takes people like you, people who have been affected by the content that we're creating, who want to join us to make sure that someone somewhere else would also have a chance to listen without the barriers of paywalls. If you want to join us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner, we would be honored to stand arm in arm with you. And you can get all your questions answered right now at fortisinstitute.org. Now, let's get back to Dr. Jason Lyle. This is In the Beginning.
For me, when I study the universe, I'm studying the handiwork of God. I don't know how secular people do it. I don't know how they can enjoy something that they think is just chance.
And now back to In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Welcome back. This again is Jason Lyle with Fortis Institute. We've been discussing scientific evidence that the universe is much younger than the secular claim of 13.8 billion years. And one of those lines of evidence is the internal heat of certain planets. Internal heat basically means that the energy that a planet radiates into space is much greater than the energy it receives from the sun. So the planet was created with internal energy, and it's constantly dumping that to space. eventually the planet would have to run out of such energy. And this is a problem for the secular view, because given the rate at which the energy is lost, the planets should have lost all their internal energy long ago. But many of them haven't. Jupiter, for example, gives off twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. Every second, Jupiter receives 1 unit of energy from the sun, but gives away 2 units of energy to space. It's constantly losing energy. Now, Jupiter's a big planet, over 10 times the size of the Earth, so it can store a great amount of internal energy. And in 6,000 years, it has not yet depleted its supply. But if the planet were really 4.5 billion years old, as secularists believe, it should have run out of internal energy a very long time ago. The problem is even worse for Neptune, which radiates over 2.6 times as much energy as it receives from the sun. And Neptune is less than half the diameter of Jupiter. Why do these planets still have such internal energy? Of the 4 giant planets, only Uranus lacks substantial internal heat, yet Uranus and Neptune are virtual twins, with nearly identical mass, size, and composition. But God chose to make one of them, the one that's farther from the sun, have more internal energy. I sometimes think God does these things simply to show the absurdity of naturalism. Even some of the moons of the outer planets show evidence of internal heat. Jupiter's moon Io has so much internal heat that it is constantly erupting with sulfur volcanoes. But then again, tidal flexing between Jupiter and Europa might account for that. On the other hand, Saturn's moon Enceladus also has such internal heat, so much so that occasionally water geysers erupt on its surface. There is no significant tidal flexing for Enceladus, so its internal energy seems to be simply what is left from its creation about 6,000 years ago. Enceladus is a small moon, only 300 miles across, so it simply cannot maintain internal energy for billions of years. The geology of Pluto came as quite a shock to those who were expecting this tiny world to have run out of internal heat billions of years ago. And yet, mountain chains and lack of substantial cratering in certain areas show that Pluto has experienced recent geological activity, which is driven by internal heat. Now, if this activity happened billions of years ago, it would all be covered by craters today, but it isn't. Even Pluto's largest moon, Charon, has chasms and ridges, geology indicative of recent internal heat. The surfaces appear geologically young. By the way, the Earth also has internal heat, expelling more energy into space than it receives from the sun, but secular scientists believe that radioactive materials resupply such energy. Indeed, radioactive decay produces a small amount of heat. Whether there are sufficient radioactive sources to account for Earth's internal heat is an open question. But the point is that the outer planets and moons lack these radioactive elements. Our measurements show that the outer worlds of the solar system have low density, meaning they cannot possess significant radioactive elements, which are very dense. Their internal energy suggests that they were created thousands, not billions of years ago. Spiral galaxies are also an indication of the youth of the universe. A galaxy is a collection of millions or billions, or in some cases, trillions of stars. Now, most galaxies are either ellipsoidal or spiral in shape. The spiral galaxies have a central ellipsoid bulge of stars surrounded by a flattened disk. Our own galaxy, the Milky Way, is a spiral with over 100 billion stars, and our solar system is located in the disk. The disk of a spiral galaxy is not uniform, but has more stars concentrated into spiral arms and fewer stars between those arms. Now, spiral galaxies rotate differentially, meaning the inner parts rotate at a different angular velocity than the outer parts. So, stars closer to the core would take less time to complete a revolution than stars farther from the core. This means that any spiral structure will necessarily become tighter over time and will eventually become so twisted that any spiral structure would be lost. We know the rate at which the spiral structure is lost because we can measure their Doppler shifts of the stars as they revolve. The result is that spiral structure would become unrecognizable after 100 million years or so. But according to the standard secular model of cosmology, most galaxies are around 10 billion years old, and some are even older. Yet these galaxies still show spiral structure. They have not become twisted beyond recognition, suggesting that they are not nearly as old as secularists presume. Even if these galaxies just started out with no spiral structure at all, after 100 million years or so, they would be twisted so tightly that no spiral structure would remain. Secular astronomers refer to this as the spiral winding problem. Most secular astronomers posit that new spiral structure must somehow form, as the original spiral structure would have been destroyed by wrapping long ago. Perhaps density waves propagate around the disk, triggering new star formation. But what would cause those density waves? Well, who knows? Furthermore, spiral galaxies have a magnetic field that is aligned with the spiral arms. This is significant because magnetic fields move with material, not density waves. So if spiral arms had been recreated multiple times from density waves, we would not expect them to line up neatly with the magnetic field. On the other hand, if spiral galaxies were created as spiral galaxies and have experienced only a few thousand years of rotation, then the observations match up perfectly. Blue stars challenge the idea of billions of years. The color of a star is related to its surface temperature. Red stars are the coolest, with a meager surface temperature of 4,000 kelvins. Yellow-white stars, like the Sun, are around 6,000 kelvins. Blue stars can exceed 20,000 kelvins. Blue stars also tend to be the brightest stars, mainly because of their higher temperature. They tend to be the most massive stars, which creates high pressure in the core, resulting in higher levels of energy production in the core. Some blue stars are thousands of times more luminous than the Sun, meaning they expend their energy much more quickly than other types of stars. As the saying goes, the candle that shines twice as bright lasts half as long. Blue stars have the shortest possible lifespan of any star. Now, stars are apparently powered by nuclear fusion, the conversion of hydrogen into helium in their core. Hydrogen is therefore the fuel that is spent as the star shines, radiating its energy into space. There are various scientific methods by which we can measure the size and mass of stars, so we know how much fuel is available, and we know the rate at which the fuel is expended by measuring the amount of energy released by the star. That is simply related to its luminosity. Therefore, we can compute the maximum time that a star can shine before running out of fuel. The small red stars use up their fuel very slowly and can therefore potentially last many billions of years, exceeding the secular estimated age of the universe. Stars like the Sun use up their fuel more quickly and could potentially last perhaps 10 billion years. But the hottest blue stars have a maximum lifespan in the millions of years range. And yet blue stars are abundant, particularly in the arms of spiral galaxies. The stars of Orion's Belt, for example, are blue stars and cannot be billions of years old. Blue stars seem to indicate that the universe was created recently and is not millions, let alone billions of years old. To my knowledge, no secular astronomer denies that blue stars are young. But they insist that the universe is old and therefore these blue stars have somehow formed from a collapsing cloud of gas and very recently. But this rescuing device has a number of problems. Gas resists compression. Everyday experience informs us that gas tends to expand and fill its container. Now, in space, there is no container, and therefore gas tends to expand indefinitely. Indeed, astronomers have never detected gas that is in the process of contracting. Now, once a star is made, its own gravity will hold the gas together, preventing expansion. But for a giant cloud of gas in space, the inward force of gravity is very meager and is generally dwarfed by the outward force of gas pressure. Furthermore, if the gas cloud has even the slightest rotation, its own angular momentum will tend to prevent collapse. And magnetic pressure also resists collapse. So the idea of stars forming spontaneously from collapsing clouds seems unlikely from a scientific perspective. Now, I will not say it's impossible, but the conditions under which it could occur are very constrained. To make matters worse, these problems scale with mass. This means that the least likely star to result from a collapsing cloud would be a blue star, the very type that secularists require to form in abundance. Secularists must accept that it happens, or else they would have to relinquish their belief in billions of years, since blue stars cannot last that long. But for the moment, the formation of blue stars is not science, but merely wishful thinking. The universe is precisely the age that the Bible indicates. It is not billions of years old. Now, this fact goes against what the majority of scholars today believe, but that isn't new. The Bible has long been contrary to the majority opinion of the day, only to be vindicated by later research. But we don't have to wait 1,000 years to see if the Bible is right about the age of the universe. Already, there is abundant evidence from astronomy that makes no sense within the secular timescale. Now, I realize that secular astronomers have their rescuing devices for these lines of evidence, but the consistent Christian can accept the science at face value. So I hope this information has been helpful to you. God bless.
This has been In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, a production of Fortis Institute. Our website is fortisinstitute.org, and it is your central hub for all things Fortis. If you've enjoyed In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, consider subscribing and sharing with your friends and church family. Also, would you prayerfully consider joining this labor of love by becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner? And until next time, go serve your King.